You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beej, the optimistic newbie developer. Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. This week, we're talking about what you need to know about numbers in order to be a good programmer. We'll talk about bits, bytes, nibbles, words, and different ways that numbers are represented and the little gotchas that you have to be aware of when coding. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
Well, this week I have moved my server, or our server, over to Linux.
Nice.
It's running Linux Mint with a Cinnamon desktop. And right before you got in today, I actually got a VM on my Windows machine in the other office over here to remote access this thing. So I don't have to walk
Sweet.
When I'm messing with everything. I could not ever get Windows to let me SSH into the box. It wouldn't respond to a ping. Nothing based on name. Linux, I popped it open in the VM. It worked the first time. So I don't know what's going on there other than, Windows being on crack like it typically is.
Well, yeah.
So that's looking like that's going to work. I probably have another 15 hours or so of work to actually get it where I want it. And you and I got to write some shell scripts.
Oh, fun.
And that, 'cause you still get to play apprentice on this because I don't want to do it all.
It's all right. That's something I have been wanting to pick up. So.
Well, you can write all of them then.
That, but.
So how about you?
Had an interesting week this past week. Started off Wednesday afternoon. I went to get the oil changed in my truck, and probably about 50 feet before the turn, heard this loud crunch and grinding noise, and pulled on up into the oil change place. Told them about what was going on. I was like, right before I pulled in, I heard this crunch and grind. They're full service, so they took a look at it. And they're like, oh, it's the stabilizer arm. So it's kind of rusted, just needs to be replaced, and it's like $200. I'm like, all right. I said, can I drive it with it? Because I had a meeting Thursday morning. He's like, oh, yeah. I was like, okay, so I can come in tomorrow afternoon after that meeting. He's like, yeah, that's no problem. All right, cool. So I get the oil changed, go on home, no problem. Start heading to work the next day. Get on the interstate. And of course, it's grinding and stuff. I'm like,
so, like, what kind of grinding, crackling noise was it? I mean, was it like Rice Krispies or like rolling over and getting out of bed after the age of 35?
The latter.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I'm driving along. I'm like, man, I just got to get to work and then go get it fixed. And I'm thinking, I may not drive back to Murfreesboro. I may just get it fixed in Nashville. And then someone honks at me and points, and I look out the side of the truck. I mean, I'm sitting in traffic.
Yeah.
Tire smoking.
That's usually not a good sign.
Yeah. So I pulled over side of the road. It's smoking pretty bad. Just coming out from under the tire. Called my uncle, who knows a lot about cars and stuff, and he was like, yeah, that doesn't sound like the
That's
stabilizer bar.
That's normal operating mode.
Yeah. He's like, that's something worse. You need to get a tow truck to come pick you up. I was like, that's fine, because I got tow service.
And it turns out I don't like my vehicle to be on fire.
Yeah. As I'm on the phone with him, a car pulls over and starts backing up. Like, pulled over pretty far in front and starts backing up. Like, who in the world is... Like, I just need to tell him, hey, I don't need help. I'm on the phone. I figured they would have seen that. And then I recognized the car. Spider.
Ah.
He was on his way to work.
Wow.
Yeah.
He is handy when he shows up sometimes.
He is. I know. Somehow. You never know when he's going to show up.
Stuff like that. That was a really weird day, just in general, because we were standing in the parking lot at my work and talking to one of the guys. We'd just gotten back from lunch. We had a development meeting that was basically all of us going out and, getting a decent lunch. And we're standing there, and there's one guy that has luck like yours, which is to say it's either really good or really bad. He doesn't have any in the middle.
That's how I described it when I got to work.
And so we're standing there, And, you know, the boss is on the phone. We're heading into the building, really. And he's standing there and he's kind of talking. And all of a sudden, the boss yells. He's like, Sean, watch out. And Sean immediately steps aside and a tire comes flying through. It had jumped the berm and flown through and bounced and hit his vehicle.
Wow.
Just barely missed him. And, of course, you know, by then you don't see the vehicle that it came off of. And so it's just like suddenly a wild tire.
Wow.
And of course, you know, then we're like having this, you know, we put the tire up by the tree at, you know, side. It didn't do any damage or anything. And then we're having this debate over how that could have happened, like how the physics would have worked out, because you've got a big wad of nerds standing outside when this happens. And so, you know, the guy comes around like a little bit later and we go out and we go, okay, were you making a left turn? Did you hit a bump? We're like, he's like, what? Is everybody okay? We're like, yeah, we're totally fine. You just got a bunch of dorks in here just trying to figure out the physics. And there's bets being placed.
You guys,
like, you just got to resolve that. This for us. And he, you know, he was a big burly guy, you know, and like, didn't really know what to make of us. He just kind of was like, yeah, I made a left turn. See ya. Anyway, so back to yours.
So I have it towed back to where I had gotten the new tires put on and told them what was going on. They took it apart. Apparently, when I had gotten the front tires put on, not there at a different place, they hadn't packed the ball bearings right. That had worn down and just destroyed the front assembly, wheel assembly, totally.
Are you able to go after the people that did it before and get them to pay for the damage?
I hadn't thought about that.
You might look.
Yeah. It's been several months, so it may be just like, well, we did it right, and it just, you were supposed to redo this or that. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, anyways, so it cost quite a bit, and it took them 2 days to fix. So, I, not having anybody else, called my dad, who lives 2 hours away. He drove down, picked me up, and drove me the 15 minutes home.
Yeah.
So, I could get my bike and ride to work. This time, it's probably around 12:30 or 1 by the time he got down there and stuff. And on the way to work, a pipe fell off the back of a truck and almost impaled me.
Beej, I gotta tell you, when you start having bad luck, what you need to do is just go into a room with nothing in it and sit there for a day or so.
The roof would collapse.
Get a room without a roof.
I get struck by lightning.
Go to the desert. You got to do something. Like, when your luck starts going bad, like, it's a streak of it. Like, you don't ever have, like, one thing happen. It's just like, holy moly, what happens to him? So.
So that. Wow. Yeah, exactly.
So you got to, I guess it's about time to roll the IoTs thing. And you can tell us about things that would interact badly with your luck, probably.
Yeah, let's go ahead and roll the music. This week for IoTs, I have a service called Smart Living Maker. It's an end-to-end Internet of Things solution for tech enthusiasts, developers, and makers. You can connect an Arduino, Raspberry Pi, Intel Edison, or pretty much any other smart device you want to the cloud services, and automate with simple when-then rules, kind of similar to like IFTTT. But it also gives you data. You can visualize the data and has a mobile and web dashboard. You can also get on there and discuss concepts and your projects with experts and other people who are making things. So it's kind of neat. It's got a little community and a few other neat things about it. So I'll have a link in the show notes.
So Beej, who's talking to us this week?
Well, we have a little something special. Someone who has left a comment before via email, left us a review in iTunes. And I think this is someone you know, Mark Carringer.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark says, Will and BJ do an excellent job providing information and advice for up-and-coming developers. Although both hosts work in the .NET world, the emphasis is on the skills needed by developers. This podcast is professionally produced with excellent sound quality. The creators understand that a good podcast must have a reliable structure that a listener can count on every episode. The overall trope is that of a dialogue between experienced developer and a newbie developer, sort of a Don Quixote dynamic. Will is adept at providing metaphors for advanced concepts that will stick in your mind, while BJ frequently manages to ask the questions you would have asked. The shows are about an hour in length.
So I'm curious, on the whole Don Quixote thing, like, which one of us is charging at the windmill here?
You read my notes afterwards.
Yeah.
yeah. You know, I appreciate the professionally produced part of that, Mark. Actually, it really means a lot because we put a lot of effort into it.
And by we, he means he.
Yeah. I do the editing, and thanks to our friend Jason down in Atlanta, he trained me on how to do the mastering. So shout out to him, too, because he is a big part of the audio quality of this show. But thanks, Mark. We really do appreciate the review, and we've got some more Complete Developer swag just for you.
Yeah, we need to figure that out pretty soon.
Yep. If you'd like some Complete Developer swag, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website or any of our social media. We post all our episodes to Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and
to that one guy on Google+.
Yes. So, starting us out, why are numbers really that difficult?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems like it would be kind of simple in practice. But we've said before that numbers are representations of things, not things themselves. Mm-hmm. And this little bit of abstract stuff makes things a little bit tricky. The big thing is you have to be able to store and process numbers in an efficient manner in order for your programs to run well. That's, you know, I mean, literally computing is, it was initially just all numbers. There wasn't text really involved.
Yeah. The thing is, those numbers also have to be accurate.
Yes.
We can't lose data in the process of storage, retrieval, or arithmetic functions.
Right. Because then, you know, various things happen. Servers crash, you know, Martian landers crash. It's just not good.
Yeah.
And at the root, things are stored as base 2, which is otherwise known as binary. And the problem is that some numbers are difficult, if not impossible, to accurately represent in binary. Take an irrational number like pi.
I like pi.
Yeah, you're not. You represent a approximation of pi, mm-hmm. not pi itself, because I mean, it doesn't matter what you're storing it in. Like, it's not going to fit in anything.
That's true. That's why we need them petabyte drives,
right? So that you can make sure that you know exactly the area of that circle. And the only person that can debate it with you is someone richer. But we do have to have a pretty high degree of precision because, you know, computers are used in engineering type disciplines. They're used in financial transactions. Like, if we start getting this stuff wrong en masse, a whole lot of people are going to die.
Yes, that's true.
And it's also really bad for the bottom line of companies that you happen to be working at when your software does bad things with numbers and causes problems in various ways.
Yeah, because, you know, if the company doesn't make money, they don't have anything to pay you with.
Right. They don't have anything to put in your bank account when there's nothing in theirs.
Yes.
And, you know, we got into this with pi before, but our way of storing numbers can be difficult if a number's too big to mm-hmm. represent in the area of storage. Now, this is not as big of a deal now as it was, say, 30 years ago, you know, when you were very, very limited and you had, mm-hmm. you know, 64 kilobytes is enough for anybody.
Yeah.
Right. When you had that mindset, it's like, okay, well, you know, how are you going to represent a, you know, astronomical distance in something and also have a program that manipulates that data with multiple variables, you know, like that gets pretty ugly on memory usage. And the thing is, these problems, we've mitigated it by throwing hardware at it. But that doesn't mean the problems have gone away. And some of the ways that we've done these things are still around.
How are numbers stored then?
Well, it's all bytes, right?
Well, everything's a byte.
Well, everything's a bit or a set of bits.
Yeah.
So, you know, a byte is a group of 8 bits, and a bit is a value that's true or false.
And half a byte is called a nibble.
Yes, because someone wanted to be clever, and that was the best they could do. which is probably just as well that be left alone there.
Yeah.
Now, a word is a fixed size chunk of bytes, and that's defined by the processor architecture. So, it's the number of bits that are processed in one shot.
So is this what it means by 32 or 64?
Right. So it's the word size. Okay. And of course, you know, back in the day, like I can remember it being 16 and I programmed against that. And now it's a 64. And it's typically 32 or 64 on home computers.
Just think one day it'll be 256.
Right. I mean, there's a limit to how much of that is actually useful.
Yeah.
As well, because most numbers that we actually need that are integers will fit in 64 bits. Mm-hmm. Because 2 to the 64th, with some caveats that we'll discuss here in a minute, that typically is enough for most applications that are terrestrial in nature. Like, unless you're going into space or you're dealing with, you know, crud, you could have the amount of money that is on the planet will fit in that, as far as like dollar value. Of course, it's, you know, not.
What about in pesos?
Yeah. Or Zimbabwean dollars during the crash. You know, that might be a problem. But most of the time, we get away with this. Now, so the basic rule is that an integer representation of a number can represent at most 2 raised to the number of bits in that type, right? So, you know, a single byte that's 8 bits could be 2 to the 8th.
And that's because the 2 is...
Well, it's either on or off.
The 2 is on or off and, you know, raised to the number of times you can do
right
on and off.
Yeah, it's just how many different states that thing can be in.
Yeah, okay.
And the more bytes you have, the more of those states. And so and it increases very, very fast. Mm-hmm. Now, that's at most... You know, obviously there's cases that make that a little bit challenging, and we'll get there in a minute. Bytes can also be signed or unsigned, and this is where part of this comes in. The signing of it is basically a way to say, is this negative or positive?
No, I think that would just take one bit.
It does.
Okay.
Right, so you still have the same range. In other words, you have the same number of states, but half of them are below zero now. Right. So, you know, instead of it going to 256, it's, you know, minus 127 to 128. You know, they do shenanigans there. But obviously, if you don't know which one you're dealing with and you get the wrong one, you know, you just misread the thing. So you could be off by quite a bit.
Okay.
Quite substantially. So that's the first thing. And I think most people have probably, if they're programming very long, they have run into this. Mm-hmm. Because there's enough things that are unsigned. That'll come up. When you try to increment a byte value past what it will hold, there's two different things that can happen, depending on, like, this is at a very low level. And typically, you don't do one of these. It can throw an error, or it can overflow the value. In other words, hey, it's completely full, now it's zeros.
Kind of like
Super Mario Brothers, when you had that, there was one board in there where you could do a little trick to get infinite lives, and it would roll up, and then all of a sudden you get up to FF, and then you go back to zero lives left.
Yeah.
That's because that's the way they were doing that counter. Instead of doing all the checks, because it's faster that way.
Okay.
You just always have a rule for how this thing moves versus going, oh, hey, I'm full. I need to throw an error and do all this other crap on the stack. It's just, nope, just roll it over. See that very often now.
So, I was thinking of the odometer on, like, an older car to where, you know, you hit 100,000 and it rolls over.
Yeah. Especially, you know, like, American cars from the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you know, they didn't expect them to run that long.
Yeah.
You know, why would they fix that? That's like a Y2K problem. That's way out there. But, you know, this can happen. Most of the time now, you're not going to see this, but it is something to be aware of. With some types of systems. And there's reasons that you might do this, right? Like, for instance, if you have a counter that says, okay, once a minute, increment this counter, and every time it's divisible by 4, in other words, third bit from the end is set, then do some action. Well, it's like, well, if it's going to roll over, I don't care, because it's always going to fit within that if it's unsigned.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so, like, that's a little bitty optimization that some... you know, Uber geek might have made in the 80s. Now people are going to glare at you for doing that kind of stuff unless you're coding an assembler all the time. That sort of stuff happens. You do have to be very cautious, though, you know, just on the off chance of this sort of thing. Very bad things have happened. There was a machine that was called the Therac 25.
Familiar.
Yes. Well, you went into medicine.
Yeah.
This is where bad computing intersected with medicine. You don't want to notice computing's intersection with medicine.
No.
In general.
Not at all.
Like, it should be in the background or not there.
Well,
like,
Especially back when I first started. Yeah, I'll say back when I first started, I could see that. Now everything has to be like electronic medical records and everything. So
yeah. But the Therac 25 was a radiation therapy machine. Now, there was a one-byte counter that was getting overflowed in the method I was describing to you. And that was due to a race condition. In other words, it's doing asynchronous processing. And if you timed it when it was adjusting one thing and you hit a certain button while that adjustment was happening, that counter got overflowed. Right? It's a software error that caused an interlock to fail. That interlock controlled the amount of radiation that patients were being hit with, and it hit them with 100 times the intended dose of beta radiation. It caused 3 deaths and gave quite a few people radiation burns and radiation sickness.
Let alone the long-term effects of that.
Right. They have cancer. They have died by now. Yeah. More than likely. This is why numbers are important.
It's also why you recently did a kind of a rant for Tricks of the Trade on bugs.
Yeah.
This is why you need to treat bugs.
Yeah, because, seriously. I mean, it was just a stupid little counter in one little component. But the cascading effect killed people. This is why I don't like calling them bugs. They're defects. So I guess the next thing is, let's talk about what we do with numbers and why the different problems come to pass.
Well, let's start off with simple arithmetic operations.
Right. So addition, subtraction, multiplication, division.
Long algebra.
No.
Differential equations.
Right. Now, we already talked about what can happen with a plus or minus.
Yeah.
With overflowing, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you can also have a loss of precision when you divide, or with multiplication, you can have an overflow, right? So those are pretty simple. Another thing that happens is conversion to a string representation for display or printing. Now, this works out, just fine until you have a stupid algorithm that, say, does something like dumps a whole bunch of digits out on the screen, just keeps going, keeps calculating what this value actually is, like with pi, and then dumps it to a printer, like you're going to burn a printer eventually.
Oh, I've not done that. But, I've just printed out stuff like that to the screen.
But the other thing, it's also very easy to display something, and it's like, okay, well, this value is zero. Well, actually, it's 0.01, which means there is something there versus not something there. And, and if you're truncating it, you're giving a wrong value. So that's one place that this can go quite wrong. Now, you also have other things like more complex functions. So you think of all your trig functions. Well, what happens with, sine and cosine? Yeah, you kind of got a range that you're working in, and not too big of a deal, but tangent, you can get an overflow. The next one is binary operations. And this is stuff like your AND, your OR, your XOR, et cetera.
Boolean algebra.
Right. So that's the thing of, if I take 4 and 2 and I AND those, I get 0 because the bits, the bit for 4 and the bit for 2 are set in the 2 different ones, but not in both.
Yeah.
So then that's what the AND operation does. It consolidates that. So it'll clear it. If I OR it, I'll get 6. Yeah. And if I XOR it, I'll also get 6 in that particular case because where the bit positions are. Whereas if I XOR 2 with 2, I get 0. This, by the way, is a trick that you'll see in assembler programming, at least last time I looked. Is if you have a CPU register that has a value in it, it's faster to XOR it with its own value than it is to pull a zero out of memory and put it there. Because you can do a CPU operation that says XOR it with itself and go away versus I have a constant that's in slightly slower storage.
You've told me this before. It makes more sense now with what we just discussed.
Right.
Yeah.
It's one of those little mathematical tricks that somebody goes, hey, let's do this. And that's great. Now, you'll see this a lot of other places too. You'll see this with bit masks. If you've ever dealt with TCP/IP, like, you have the 192.168, .1.1 or .1.0. And you'll typically also see a subnet mask that's 255, 255, 255, 0. Well, that means that you have one byte of addresses that you can change that's within your network, and the rest is basically fixed for that subnet. Okay. That allows you to say, okay, how big of a subnet do I want versus how many addressable networks do I want? It's a little bit more complicated than that, but it's a way of shifting the address space. And so if you don't know the bit mask, you don't know how big that network is, and you can overflow it. You can get a value that you don't have the right to access. So
okay.
Yeah, that's you will see that show up on occasion. And I kind of butchered that explanation because that, like, getting into all the networking stuff is going to take a minute.
Yeah.
Now, another one that you don't think of very often is the shift operators. And that's where if I have a stream of bits, okay, I can I can, for instance, if the first bit is zero, if I shift that thing to the left, I just multiplied it, you know, if I shifted it left by one position, the whole thing, I just multiplied it by two. You'll see the shift operators happen there too. And those will typically fall off, right? You shift and clear it. Mm-hmm. At least that's the way I've seen it. You still don't see this very much, but it happens at a low level for certain particular use cases. Again, not very common, but there you go. The other thing we do with numbers, and this is where you will get burned very badly, is we use them as the underlying representation for other data types, because that's what we have, is bytes. That's yeah. what we have to use. And so you can have, for instance, a floating point error, but you know it's in a floating point type that is being wrapped by a date time type, right? And because you have a floating point error and you use this thing in calculations using the underlying type, but representing it as a date time, you can be off by a couple hours. And if you're off by a couple of hours and say it's a trajectory, now you're off by a large. Like this is the potential for a lot of things to compound.
Why is every month 31 days in JavaScript?
You'd have to ask Douglas Crockford about that one. Because, you know, presumably this is one of the good parts of JavaScript. I don't know. That's, yeah, I think that was just, you know, maybe a shortcut thing. That's one of those weird things. So let's talk about first, let's go into the integer numbers. Because they're represented several different ways, and you will see these. Binary, nobody writes things out in binary for the most part, but on occasion, it's useful to be able to do that so that you can, you know, do bit masks and things like that so you can understand what's going on. Like in .NET, we just got binary constants in this, C#6. I forget which one. They were going to release it in one, and then they didn't, and then they came back, and, you know.
I'm pretty sure it's in 6.
It's coming at some indeterminate point in the future, but like we haven't really needed it.
Yeah.
We've gotten by without it, but you have to be able to convert things to binary in your head, so it's better to have the literal. You'll also see octal. You'll see base 8. And the reason you see base 8 and base 16 hexadecimal is they're both nice shorthands for binary.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Because of the, you know, and there's some mathematical reasons that I'm not completely qualified to really go, okay, here's what the things are called. It's like, this is a shortcut and it works. You know, I'm the pitcher, not the physicist describing the ball game. Like, I'm sure, you know, we'll find somebody that can do that, but that isn't me. And then there's also decimal, which is what the rest of us use. And this is for...
Could it also be because of the whole 8 bits to a byte?
I think it was just a useful shorthand. I'm not entirely sure why octal got used to the degree that it did versus hexadecimal. And it may have been one of those things that like one side of the Atlantic, they did this, and one side of the Atlantic, they did that, or one side of the Pacific, they did this, and one side of the Pacific, they did that. And because communication channels were slow, ideas didn't spread.
Gotcha.
That's one of those things that's probably lost to history, to be 100% honest. Okay. So integer numbers, there's all these different representations, and you obviously have to be able to figure out which one you're in. Because if you see 1, 0, what is that? Well, in binary, that's 2, right? What is that in octal?
I don't know. I'm trying to think. I'm like, I know what it is in decimal.
Well,
what is it in octal?
That would be 8 in octal. I had to think about that a minute.
What is it in hex?
16. Yeah, that's pretty easy there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's double. You know, and obviously in decimal, we know what that is because, you know, except for the occasional person with the extra finger, we have 10 of these. So you just have to be sure that you know what the underlying representation is when you're reading it from a string. That kind of matters. Now, here's where things really get ugly. And this is where you get non-integer numbers. Because it turns out there's more of those than there are of integers.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, there's an infinite number of non-integer numbers between any two integer numbers.
And there's an infinite number of integer numbers.
Right. So there's lots of them. Like, I hate numbers and stuff. There's like so many of them, right? I forget what that was from. I have a bad feeling it's like Beavis and Butthead or something. But anyway, when you represent a non-integer number, there's two pieces that are used in the storage typically. The first is a significand, mantissa, or coefficient, which is a signed digit string of a particular length in a particular base, which is called the radix. I think you've probably seen the radix come up when you've been parsing strings into integers in JavaScript.
Don't remind me of that.
Yeah. Okay, that's the first piece, right? Is you've got your mantissa or your coefficient. And the second piece is a signed integer exponent, which modifies the magnitude of the first number. Now, most of us are going to hear this and go, okay, that's great. And then there's mathematicians that are going to go, but then there's some numbers you can't represent. And that's right. You win cash and prizes. Not really.
Not from us.
Yeah. From somebody out there. Just go find them. Now, these can be stored in, you know, different bases. Base 2 is the most common for, you know, hardware reasons. To get the actual value of the number versus its representation in storage, you multiply the mantissa by the base raised to the power of the exponent. In other words, it's formulaic. Basically, there's a difference between the representation on disk and the representation, you know, what the actual number is. And it's essentially a compression algorithm is what it is, because you don't want this massive amount of bytes being used for this, because, okay, let's say that you get past the word size of your processor, which you probably will.
Yeah.
Well, what's the trade-off between your accuracy and the amount of processing power you wasted getting that accuracy? So this is kind of shorthand. This is why floating point is very, very nasty if you're not careful. The decimal is not stored. In other words, the little period there, it's not put anywhere. You know, it's just a, you know, base value and a magnitude type arrangement. And I know that this is kind of hard to visualize. You'll have to look it up. And I put a link here. You know, Wikipedia's got a very good article on floating point representation. If you really, really want to get into it, it's not really necessary to actually know how it's represented, just the fact that it's not represented with perfect accuracy. So here's the stuff that makes this nasty. The length of the significand or mantissa, which is easier to pronounce, so I'm going to call it the mantissa from now on so I don't get tongue-tied. The length of the mantissa tells you how precisely you can represent a number. In other words, it's a degree of precision. So it's the same principle if I go, you know, 1.62 times 10 to the eighth, right? That's less accurate than 1.628 times 10 to the eighth.
Yes.
If I'm going for the larger number. So the length of that, in other words, affects how close you can get to numbers that are way out there.
So this is scientific notation.
Effectively, yeah. Or it's engineering notation. It's that same kind of numerical theory.
Okay. Okay. Because I'm trying to follow you along here, and it's just...
It's painful.
All right. And so the mantissa is which part of that?
The first part.
So it's like the 1.08.
Right.
Okay.
And then you understand, you know, of course, you've got the radix, which is the base that you're in, and then the magnitude of that radix, because it'll be, you know, base 2 times
so it'll be like 10 or 1.08 whatever. Times 2 to the
right
whatever, or times 2. Okay.
Yeah, and it's understood what the radix is. Like, that's not stored as part of it.
This what does this have to do with logs? Because this seems some...
Logs.
Logarithms?
Oh, lordy. There's a lot of math under here. If your sister's listening, she's probably going to be like, you know,
in heaven,
either in heaven or in hell, and we'll know either way. So a lot of this, you kind of have to know that this stuff is there. It's not like you don't count the stripes on the tiger. You just stay out of the jungle.
Yeah. Okay.
Now again, you get. You know, with the fact that the length of the mantissa tells you how accurately you can represent a number, that also tells you the other fact in the mix, which is there's some numbers you can't represent.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's
you might be able to get close. Well, it's not just irrationals. It's
yeah. There's not a base that you can use to represent all numbers accurately.
Right. And you know, I wish we could find like some crazy mathematician that could put things in a way that would really, really get you there. But I don't know how to do that except for just, you know, basically beating your head against a math book for a few years. And then all of a sudden some of these things clear up.
That sounds like fun, actually.
Yeah. So weird. Yeah. So again, like I said, you can't, there's no base you can find to represent all numbers accurately. It's there's the thing and there's the way you represent the thing. And the latter doesn't completely map to the former. This is what we talked about in that April 1st episode.
Mm-hmm.
But you can approximate them to a degree of accuracy, which really is all you need anyway. Because if I measure something and it's an inch in length, that's not necessarily an inch. It might be an inch and 1/10,000th of an inch in length.
Yeah.
Like we deal with this every day. We, you know, we kind of wing it. Some of us more than others.
Well, I'll be honest. If you had a father or a sibling or even a mother that was, you know, into building things.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Or cooking.
Well, building things.
Yeah.
For this example. Okay. Those into building things. One of the things that they say a lot is measure twice, cut once.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, you may measure it once and get one measurement and again and get a different one.
Yeah. Cause all of our measurement systems are inaccurate to some degree.
Yes.
You know, that's the fundamental deep well that you look into when you start dealing with real world systems.
And it goes back into numbers are representative of things. In this case, they're representative of distance.
Right. And same thing with cooking measurements, right?
Yeah. Well, yes.
Yeah, because I cooked all weekend. And, you know, when it said a clove of garlic, my definition of a clove of garlic is 2 heaping tablespoons of the chopped. But I might be overusing it. So anyway, that's in the mix. Now, you know, some examples. You can't perfectly represent 1/5 in binary base, but you can in decimal. And you can't represent 1/3 in either base, but if you had an arbitrary base 3 system, it's trivial. And this is all from Wikipedia because goodness knows I'm not going to do the math to figure this out. Like, I know it's there.
The 1/5 I didn't know. It makes sense thinking about it now, but it wasn't something... When you were talking about that...
But you can get horrendously close to it where it doesn't matter.
When you were talking about that, the first thing that popped into my mind was the thirds. You know, 0.33333 repeating.
Right.
0.6666 repeating.
Yeah. 0.9999 repeating, which is 1.
Yeah.
Again, the representation is not the thing. Now, this gets better because the way the computer stores these things is implementation dependent, and there are different formats. They're kind of... working on fixing that, obviously, over time, because turns out that this really hurts. You know, just it causes a lot of problems. But typically, it's going to be IEEE 754 encoding. If you really want to go look that up, there's a spec. Knock yourself out. So, guess what happens when you do arithmetic operations on approximations of two numbers and then try to compare the result to something else?
I would say you don't get more accurate.
Right.
You lose accuracy.
Right. And it doesn't really matter which one you use, right? Because you're going to be off. You know, more than likely, you're not going to get more accurate and actually hit it dead on.
Well, this goes back to...
There's probably some weird combination that some, you know, some math geek with, you know, is going to figure that out and go, oh, well, there's this one case.
Let's see. This makes me think of when I was in grad school taking statistics.
Right. You have a rate of error.
Yeah. Well, you have a rate of error, and you're only as significant as your least significant.
Right. Yeah. You basically have a section to which you are confident of the value, and past that, it's noise. If you're not using an accurate enough representation when you start doing arithmetic operations, you're going to have a drift from perfect mathematical accuracy.
Yeah.
This gets real important when you're using, say, not a big enough floating point representation for something like, oh, I don't know, money. Yeah. People have been burned by this. There was the plot of one of the Superman movies and Office Space also.
Office Space.
The rounding error.
Yeah.
Coming off there. Like, if you can accurately calculate that.
And it was Superman 3, by the way.
Yeah. Right. That's where this comes from, is this whole floating point representation. Like, that's the story behind that part of the movie. This is obviously worse with engineering calculations.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when it's, you know, it's some floating point number to some magnitude, and you've got some representation that just diddles with the mantissas of those two and then fixes the magnitudes up, because now you're off by a lot. The other thing that this does to you is that it means you have fuzzy comparisons. So if I go, you know, this floating point number times this floating point number, and I get this other floating point number, and then I want to compare it to this other thing that's just a constant. I don't say, are they equal? I say, is the difference between them less than a tolerance? Because that means equality. Yeah, that means equality.
No. And as I understand it, in JavaScript, to define these terms, they just add a Y afterwards.
Add a Y afterwards?
Like, after words. Not afterwards.
Oh, yeah, like truthy.
Truthy, yeah. Falsy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, and this is true in everything. I mean, I've run into it in C#.
Yeah.
I mean, there's ways you can do this and end up with calculations that should produce the same number, but that don't because of the representation. So you have to be very, very careful and do a fuzzy comparison, essentially. This also means that you have to be careful when you serialize or deserialize, like you turn into a string and then back, because that inaccuracy is transitive, especially if you're also chopping digits off. It turns out that doesn't really help your accuracy either. So this is the big one I really wanted to hit with. This was the inaccuracy of floating point and the fact that you cannot fix it. Like, this is part, like, this is like saying, well, I don't like that gravity pulls me to the ground. Tough.
Yeah.
Like, you got to figure out how to not fall over, and understanding how floating point will do this to you is kind of part of it.
It's not a matter of figuring out how to not fall over. It's a matter of figuring out how to fall over.
Yeah. Cause you're going that way.
Yes.
You know, effectively you're either standing up or you're not, but the gravity doesn't care. And it's this way with, you know, it's just a mathematical fact of the way numbers are handled in computers. Like, there's just not a way around this. So now, this was rational numbers, right?
Yeah.
What do you do with irrational numbers? Right. So you have a non-repeating, non-terminating value. You know, you have phi or pi or, and I forgot the other one.
Sad number.
Yeah. what would you do with an irrational number in this particular case? What can you do?
A real number at it. You're going to get really fuzzy.
Well, what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to find a rational number that's close. And you probably want some degree of accuracy, right? Like, we don't want to replace pi with 22 divided by 7.
I've seen that. It makes me cringe.
You know, it's close enough for figuring out, like, hand grenade blast radius, maybe. But you really don't want to be wrong on that either. Like, there's not really a place that works very well.
Yeah.
So that's basically what you're going to have to do, is you're going to have to say, okay, I want it to this degree of accuracy. And you have to take into consideration the type of operations you're going to do on that number that might decrease the accuracy of future calculations. This is where all the numerical analysis stuff comes in, that like comp sci people get fed that we don't want to talk about, because once we get away from it, we don't touch it again.
No.
We just have this vague paranoia, and it serves us for the rest of our days, and that's all we need. The real point here is that you mostly don't have to have perfect accuracy with numbers when using a computer, because you don't real life. You're accurate to a point. And beyond that, you're not. I mean, if you pump gas at a gas station, you did not get exactly the amount of gas that's shown on the pump.
You probably got less because they're wanting to charge you.
Well, you know, it's probably going to round one way or another.
Yeah.
And the rounding algorithm is based off of a fluid measurement, right? And that fluid measurement has got a degree of error. Mm-hmm. And because my dad's in the gas business, I also know about another thing that's called TEA, and that's the terminal evaporation allowance. Some of that gas isn't liquid. You know, some of that volume goes away, and it's a very small amount, but it's not there. You know, some of it coats the inside of the tube after you pumped. I mean, like, you're not going to get exactly this amount. Like, the real world is messy and inaccurate. The only thing that's actually perfect numerically is something that does not exist. You just have to make sure that you're accurate enough so that the rate of your error doesn't hurt you. So you make a trade-off between, you know, storage space, processing time, and accuracy. Those are your three pieces. That trade-off used to be made at a different level than it is now.
So that pretty much wraps us up. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
I do want to kind of get into more of the numbers stuff, because the fact that you can't represent things with perfect accuracy does not mean that you're necessarily stuck. And this is something that is kind of we like to call it a binary mindset, but a lot of us programmers have got a tendency to, we have to know all the variables and be able to project something before we start doing anything. And I just want to throw out there that, you know, that that works if you're sending a manned mission to the moon. It doesn't work so well in a lot of other areas of life. You know, your interpersonal relationships, like, you can't really calculate those. Like, just assume that they're kind of subject to a lot of floating point error and then go on and do things. It's just very important to be able to have a degree of tolerance of some degree of unpredictability. And that's what this is really all about. The numerical processing thing is a part of it, right? We're already dealing with a degree of unpredictability in our computing and in our the things that we're representing. We're already dealing with it. So don't get stuck in a binary mindset of, I have to be able to predict everything that's going to happen perfectly, or I'm not going to start. And Beej and I've experienced this with the podcast. We'll do stuff like, oh, I want to market it this way. And well, I don't know what kind of results we'll get. And he and I are both, we're the world's worst at this, because we'll him and haul back and forth for like 2 days over how we're going to spend $20. And it's the stupidest thing in the world. And we both do it. And it's because we have that mindset of, I've got to be able to completely, you know, I've got to be able to say, I have this input, and then this will happen, and then I'll have this output. And the thing is the only thing I know is the input, and I'm not real sure about that. And it's completely okay. Like, if we had actually not hemmed and hawed and just said, spend the $20 and then see what happens and then adjust, it's easier to adjust to small errors that happen from doing something than to make something happen with perfect predictability the first time. This is why we do TDD, you know, test-driven development, by the way. That's a project-level manifestation of this same mindset. So do something and adjust. Iteration's cheap. Planning is not. That's all I got.
Stand by for Titanfall.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.